Greetings, fellow travellers, and welcome to the Way of the Showman, where we view the world through the lens of showmanship. I am Captain Frodo, and I will be your gracious host and guide along the way. And today, we are back in the Showman studio with Jay Gilligan, master juggler, and over the last few years we have become very good friends, and I thoroughly enjoy each conversation that I have with him, and we are going to have a few conversations with him coming up as we take on this conversation idea for a few episodes. And we thought that it could be interesting to do some reflections now that Reflex, the show that we collaborated on, has actually happened. So I thought that maybe we could do a little recap, because one thing we've talked quite a bit on this when I've talked with interviews before with Morgan James and with Jay, then it's sort of been specifically about creation. But this today then becomes a little bit more about what does it look like and what happens when you're actually trying to put all the ideas that you've had, all the scripting that you've done. We'll talk a little bit about that too, continue to talk about the creation. But also, like, what was it like then to put all of that onto the stage and flying to New York City and all this stuff? So I thought we'd just have a quick chat about that. So we did. The conversation is about 2 hours, so I will keep this brief. And let's just jump right into the middle of the conversation.
So we worked on Reflex for a year and a half or a couple years. And now it happened. I went to New York City and I did the first phase of the project. And so that's done now. But I was really remembering, because we wanted to talk about how that went, I was kind of really remembering back to the very, very beginning of the process. I know we've talked about it a lot, but this idea that we were trying to make something out of nothing, and we were really trying to search and find what is the point. It wasn't just a given assumption. Hey, we're going to do a show. Yeah. So go out and juggle some, go do some tricks and maybe tell some stories. And oh, it'd be funny if you tell the story like that. We're really searching to try to find fundamentally what in the world we were trying to do. And also in that, imagining who we were going to do it for. And that's the fun thing today, is now that's all happened. So we can actually talk. We can actually talk about how that went.
It's interesting to bring to look at something, and then the people can go back to the episode where we spoke about this before, or the video where we spoke about this before, in all our ideas of leading up to it. And now we can reflect on some of those things, that what changed when it actually became real or whatever. But one thing that I also thought was significant was the time that we created this, which was through the pandemic, when both you and me were left to our own devices without being able to have the creative outlet of doing shows, and without a proper way of taking care of our family, because both of us are making money as the main way to make money is through doing shows, and that's how we help supporting our family. So we were going through it. To me, I keep thinking of it as a dark time. It was through the winter and whatever, so it is dark in Scandinavia at that time. So it's not just a metaphor, it was actually the literal state of it. And we got to explore what we wanted to do with the show, that in our minds became like a very big deal. And this exploration of what the show is and who you are, this was also going hand in hand with when I was getting up at 5 a.m. to write for a couple of hours before going out and before my family woke up to write what's essentially the second season of my podcast. I was going through these questions, and it was all feeding back into each other. So it was a very significant time with a lot of thought going back and forth between you and me.
Maybe looking back on that, I mean, this idea of being in the pandemic and normally designing and creating performances for a specific context. So we didn't have that very specific context for the project. And I think that was a benefit for once. I mean, because I'm so quick to be like, how big is the stage? How many people, where are they sitting? Where do I come into the stage? And then you just make these fast decisions. That's just how business has been in the past, couple decades, the rhythm of working. And now it was like, well, we were going to do it in New York because that's what Hideaway Circus proposed. And what in the world does that mean? Like, what's how many people are in the venue? How many shows are we going to do? We had no idea. And yeah. That obviously drove me crazy sometimes because I really do hang on and really do rely upon the logistics of the situation to really spark my creativity. And so we had this idea of like, hey, where's the show going to be? We don't know. Who's going to watch the show? We don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was like, well, what do we want to say? And then it did kind of allow us to maybe be a little bit more free than normal in terms of what we want to say, because the only metric we could measure what we were doing was our own desires. And then and that's always a funny thing, you know, when you ask an artist and you say, well, what do you want to say? And you're like, well, because when you're performing and there's an economic mechanism tied to that creation, suddenly there's all these other concerns. Well, what's the producer going to think? What's the audience going to think? Well, if I juggle silver clubs, they're going to look flashier. Maybe I'm going to get more ticket sales, whatever, like something
yeah,
crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't have really much of that. So it was more like, oh, what do you want to say? And that was a real, I mean, such a journey, such a deep journey that I think was really productive. And in the end, really helped the performance when I went to do it in New York. I mean, it was a big risk too, because it was and it was an unknown. We were just guessing, or we were motivating our decisions by our own, make our own
desires. It's so true. I often say this about when we're doing projects or whatever, it's like we're doing it in the dark. It's like, unless we know the specifics, we're just stabbing in the dark and don't know what we're going to find. And that ties up with the idea that we were going through the pandemic and being in the dark. So we were just left a bit to our own devices. Somebody had said, we want to produce a show. What kind of show are you making? And we have often been talking about, personally, you and me, about this idea that when they just go, just do whatever you want, there's no restrictions. And when you do that and there's no restrictions, really, then it can be really difficult. But at this particular time during the pandemic, we did have the luxury of time. We had no work and we were being really introspective about what we were doing and the work I was doing with the writing the way and what we were doing on the show, two sessions a week at 2.5 hours or 3 hours or whatever. So we were just very in-depth conversations with the luxury of time and doing it in the dark, but also being in the dark about any expectations on us. So we really were left free and had that time. So it was the sort of perfect confluence of many things to expand what we wanted to do.
That thing of being like, I know exactly what you mean, that thing of like, well, you can just do whatever you want. And then on the surface, that comment is, I think, given with this intention of like being nice, like being easy. Like, hey, Frodo, I'm not going to be difficult for you in your life. Like, so you can just do whatever you want. Like, I'm trying, like, I'm, you know, like the intention is that I'm helping you because I'm easy that you can just do whatever you want. But I think this idea of you can do whatever you want, it is just that you haven't uncovered the what is necessary. So you can just do whatever you want. It's I get it on the surface. And many times that is nice. I mean, it also implies that you can then choose and discern and decipher what is necessary for that certain situation. Like I'm giving you the trust and respect that you're going to be the one who can uncover those things. But yeah, lots of times like, just do whatever you want. It's such a unhelpful situation to be in because it doesn't state all of those needs that will be there in the end. And it's kind of sticking the problem on you to figure all that out. It's like, thanks.
But it is wonderful to have this blue sky every once in a while, to have this blue sky stuff. And it does have a greater challenge. It does force us to think more and think deeper or whatever. So we certainly did that with this show. We went through the whole history of everything and our own personal, we kind of became, that's when we became deep friends as well during this just exploring life and performing and our dedication to mastery of our respective crafts.
Yeah, I think this is something that has occurred to me a bunch of times in recent years. So maybe it's just our age. I think we're we're like the same age basically. And the older I get, the more I uncover about what's going on behind the scenes with something, the less it destroys the magic of that thing, and it even enhances it. I just have so much more respect and awe and wonder at whatever that thing is that's being, you know, you take a peek behind the curtain, behind the scenes, like of your life and of your work that we got to know each other. I mean, I loved your work beforehand, but then actually getting to know how you make work and to understand the mechanics. And it's like one of those things where, you know, you hear this all the time. Oh, you're a movie maker, and now you've worked in movies for 25 years and you can't go see a film in the cinema because you just know all the mechanics of how the cuts go and how the editing goes. And you can't see the actual thing that's in front of you because you're just constantly, you know, dissecting the structure and the mechanics. But with your work, and I guess with a lot of other things in my life, the older I get, the more I know that structure of how the things are made and the process and the ideas, the more I just appreciate it. It's even more magical when I see the end result. Like now when I see your tennis rackets routine after this year, you know, after this couple year process we've had, it's even better because you're not different than me. We're both human beings, but still you've been able to make this completely wonderful thing that I could never make. So I just have even, because, you know, I understand who you are fundamentally. And I'm just like, wow, he's not Frodo's not a magical, mythical being. He's like a father like me. And then you go out on stage and you make that performance. And I'm just blown away even more than before knowing you. And that's something that's also happened. Yeah, I mean, just through this process of getting to know you, that I think this idea of uncovering the mechanics of how something works doesn't destroy it. And for me, it gives it even more, I get even more understanding of or enjoyment out of it. And that kind of links to one thing you were saying earlier about this idea of knowing about your history and linking back to the history. Because in the reflex thing, we did explore a lot of the history of juggling, a lot of my personal history. And again, that's that history is part of the mechanics or that supporting structure of the end result. And I think uncovering all those connections, I don't know. For me personally, it just gives me a much more respect and enjoyment of seeing whatever it is.
So if we try and make this a little more concrete, it's like we spent so long time in writing, and I guess the physical manifestation of what it was that we had done was we wrote a script where we included lots of, first, all the words, of course. And so I'm just thinking, like, if you're thinking that this is the end of that thing, you go to New York with with the script, and we had a week together, or was it 4 days, 5 days or something?
Oh, it's like 3 days.
3 days.
We fit a week of work.
It was a week of work done in 3 days. Yeah, that's right. I remember going home at night and just going to sleep and getting up at 7 in the morning and taking Sindri to school and straight out to the... So it was epic. But we had those days together where we knocked more shape and sense into it. And I remember spending a lot of time also on working out the reality of you speaking the script and making lots of alterations to the script and changing the beginning of the show quite a bit to reflect what it was really like to see you actually deliver the stuff. So I can't remember if we spoke in detail about that last time, if this happened after the...
I mean, what a process and a journey, because I was telling you a couple of weeks ago that whenever I go into a project where I want it to be really significant or a leap in my work, or I feel like, okay, I want this project to go somewhere new, then I have this habit of being like, oh, I don't know how to do a show. Like, I've never made a show before. And I go, because you really want to, you know, you really want to be true to yourself and say, like, or you really want to be open to new possibilities. And it's going back to that assumptions thing again. Oh, well, I assume I'll just go on stage and speak like this. And it's like, no, I want to be open to the process, especially collaborating with someone like you. I don't want to shut you out and just be like, oh, Frodo, I know how to talk, like, whatever, you know. But then it was that moment of, like, we were on stage on the floor together in the warehouse working together here in Sweden. And it was like, okay, Jay, time for you to say our opening lines. And I don't speak on stage. And then all of a sudden I'm like, I don't remember how to talk. Like, right? I mean, that's such
I remember there were some funny moments there in the beginning when it's just, we've had all these chats about what you're going to say and whatever. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, curtain goes up. You've done your first juggling act, which we don't need to go through. And now you're going to say some stuff to me. And it's also, it's artificial because it's just you and me. And it's eight in the morning in a shed in the outskirts of Stockholm. And all of a sudden you go, okay, here we go. Now the acting thing comes in and you got to make it sound fresh and go.
Right.
We spent like as long time on that initial 7 minute thing of the show, on huge sections of the show.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was really funny, that moment of like, wait, how do I talk? But in the end, I mean, it was painful to suffer through that. It was just a struggle. I mean, but I didn't enjoy it. I want to say that. I mean, that was great to go through that process. I mean, because
and it's not necessarily that you're having fun in that moment.
Right.
And it's odd because you and me like have such a respect for each other and how you talk. And all of a sudden I am changing the role into going, I don't know if this quite captures what it is that we want to do, or I try and say it like this or do this. So it changed the word. And I remember I was kept sort of paraphrasing what I thought you should say and like, oh, maybe we should say these words instead and how that would throw you off or whatever. Like it's not necessarily an enjoyable thing, but in a way it is a little bit like when you're practicing one of your tricks. It's going to keep dropping, and then you get a little further, and sometimes you get a little shorter, and sometimes you get, and then one that work that we did in the initial thing of going, how do you, the performer Jay Gilligan, say words like this in amongst your crazy skills?
Well, so that's what I was getting to is like, I mean, thanks for reminding me there, but like, because what I was getting to is like, in the end, I mean, we found out how I should speak on stage for the show. I think like we did, that did click in at one moment there. And I should just talk like how I talk, like I should just talk. And it goes back to that. And it goes back to that thing of like, oh, how do I make a show? Oh, I don't know how to make it. This is so, where are we going? I'm so lost. I don't know what the next step and what's this show going to be. I don't know. I don't know. What's the music? I don't know. Like, right. And it's all these. And then at one point, in that one moment, you just go like, when it becomes concrete, you go, oh, I do know how to make shows. I've been making shows for 35 years and I do know how to speak. I speak a lot, like actually, if you know me. So it's like, I should just speak using my voice. And then, but also that's not a trivial thing, because then there was a process behind it. And so then I could trust that process and go, oh yeah, I'm speaking with my voice, but I'm not doing something bad or wrong, like speaking in the voice like this, it's actually appropriate. And how do those words go now with that voice? So there was something to hang on to, because we'd had a validation of that choice. It wasn't just random. And without, you know, it's all about erasing that doubt in your head when you're making that new creation. And you go, yes, is this the right thing to do? Is this working? Is this the right thing to do? Is this working? So sure, it was a really silly like bunch of hours there of me literally not knowing how to speak. But then, you know, through those hours, they went behind us, and all of a sudden it was like, oh, okay, I know what I'm doing. And we talked about this a lot, and we should probably jump into New York pretty soon here. But like, even going to New York and going through that process of doing some audience test out shows here in Stockholm, we did like 6 or 7 for an audience here. And it's just selling the audience what you believe in. I mean, that was one thing I discovered, and we've said this a million times early on in the process. There's not one way to make the show work. There's not one perfect show. There's an infinite amount of perfect shows, and they're all different. And there's an infinite amount of bad shows, and they're all different. There's never one solution, I feel. And that was maybe the big takeaway of, so you just got to pick something and believe in it and sell that to the audience with your conviction. And you're, you know, that's what you want to say. And that's in the moment, the right thing to do. And just so maybe to jump into New York, it's like one of the bigger takeaways both you and I had from those 35 shows in Brooklyn was that we did succeed to make some sort of format or framework for a performance. So Reflex, instead of saying it's this specific show where you say these words in this order and you do the juggling objects like this in this order. And if anything changes, it's not the reflex show, it's a different show. It was more like we've succeeded to make some sort of platform or some sort of structure where reflex is more of a conceptual idea about, well, we can dive into what that is, but it's about uncovering some different layers behind the juggling to help the audience better take it in, right? Like that's like overarching, a very unarticulate overarching.
Yeah, but we use the word going beyond the tricks a lot. It's like right. We have the juggling and it's super high skill juggling going on in the show. It's very impressive and surprisingly innovative to the audience. But I remember as well, I like that. But you're talking about, it's like we made the show and it's a great framework, but it's also a very good show. And I haven't said this before, but I think it's almost like there's because you talk about it as a framework. And what I feel like is when you say the framework feels like what you and me did through all this work was also to unlock a whole nother dimension to you as an artist. And when you talk about the framework, I often get the feeling that that's we can talk about the impact that some of the more metaphorical and symbolic stuff that we put into the show, how that literally made people weep whilst watching juggling, which is arguably a very unusual response, and that we somehow found a way to communicate your passion for juggling and you as an artist, so that I think that happened. But I also think that the reflex show was a very strong thing in itself, even though you now also see it as a springboard to go further, where certain elements could be kept and the show could be altered, and it will probably still feel like to the people who saw the first run as maybe they're still watching Reflex, even though certain things could be significantly changed.
That's what I mean, maybe instead of framework, maybe to clarify, it's more like New York kind of gave birth to a show that is bigger than any one moment. I think I said that to you a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, that's really powerful.
Yeah, so we managed to make a piece of work that kind of exists on its own, like in a meta, like a larger conceptual world. And to get to that, to reach that place with an audience, I think there's different pathways that we can take. So we're not stuck with like, oh, I have to say that thing about the book there and I have to throw the club like that there. Because I find that a lot of times in art in general, let's stick with circus shows. Like here in Sweden, there's a lot of circus companies doing shows. Or you can even also say more specific, like, or better, that there's a lot of circus companies around the world. Let's say small circus companies. Let's say you have a show of 5 or 6 people. I see this happening all the time. I've been in projects like this. It's happened all the time where you're in a show with 6 people. One of them gets injured and that person does, let's say, juggling. So then you say, oh, we need a replacement for this person. We have to get a juggler. And it's maybe that's true, but there's also another way to look at the work, which is, what's your overall goal? Again, like, what is your overall actual thing you're trying to do? And maybe the juggling part is just incidental in terms of, again, achieving where you want to go. Maybe you could have a person who does teeterboard instead of the juggler. Maybe there's other qualities there that's actually being effective in terms of the work. And it's this idea that, and maybe some of these shows in Vegas, like some cabarets in Vegas, for example, where you go, we have a handstand, we have a acrobat, and we have a juggler and a comedian, and that's why the show works. So if we have 2 jugglers in a row or 2 in the show, we're not going to sell any tickets. Maybe it's true, but I think that points more towards this like you don't kind of fundamentally understand what you're trying to do. And it's everything's a big mystery. I find that a lot in circus and in creation, that we don't often want to uncover our process or talk about or share our process consciously, because we will destroy some sort of magical process, you know, unconscious mojo that's inside of us. And if I start to poke at that process, it'll pop the balloon and it will all fall apart.
And this is the unweaving the rainbow. Is it the Yeats poem? You're afraid of unweaving the rainbow. And what you were talking about before, as you're coming to this age that I am also, that knowing how the cake was made does not diminish my appreciation of the cake or whatever. And it's the thing that's in a magician's thing where you, if you tell people the secret, they laugh at it usually. So a comedy magician can reveal the secret and then the people laugh, whilst before that it was actually quite beautiful. And was it Yeats? I think it's Yeats that wrote that poem, Unweaving the Rainbow, of how Newton, when he worked out how light made the rainbow, that somehow he'd killed the rainbow.
Right. And,
anyway, it's...
But this idea, you know, let's say we're in a small ensemble cast and juggler gets hurt. Well, we got to replace him with the juggler. Maybe the new juggler is a great juggler, but the show is not good because the person doing the juggling, that they're bad at whatever other things were important. I mean, of course, you can find situations where you have to have that extra juggler again. But I find more often than not, especially in these small companies, these small circus shows around the world these days, it's more important who the person is rather than exactly what they do. And maybe that's a bad thing in the end, or not bad, but definitely if you think that circus is an art and circus disciplines and techniques are expressing the actual expression of the show, then maybe you have in one way failed. Like if you can just plug and play a juggler with an acrobat, and it's like, well, wait a second, what are you actually performing with? I don't think it's bad, but I think it's something to be aware of. And that's one thing with Reflex that I think really worked in New York, was that I was so happy, and that's why I called you in the first place to work on the project. I was so happy that you were able to tie the text to specific juggling technique. And I don't think in Reflex you could replace the juggling. Like, let's say I was sick one day, and we have the script. I mean, it exists, right? And I think you couldn't replace me with a handstand artist, for example. I don't think, even if you would tweak the literal words of juggling to handstand, I think the concepts we found inside of juggling technique and expanded that into the text, it was actually integrated. It was actually meaningful. It wasn't completely just metaphorical, as it often is. Like, you know, you can take a tight wire and then you can say it's about anything. I can just walk on the wire. In one show, it's about life and death, because we're all balanced. You know, our life is on that, you know, for a brief moment we live, or whatever.
Yeah.
Or I can say chaos, and then the wire is order, and then there's chaos all around us and we try to stay on the order. I don't know, just pick a metaphor. Night and day, or, you know, sun and rain, like it's just done. Your instant metaphor you can slap on top of it, but you could slap that metaphor, life and death, on top of juggling, on top of handstand. It's the same metaphor, because there's a skill involved with some sort of equilibrium that you're trying to do inside the skill. But I think in Reflex, you somehow managed to definitely weave the text deeper with the technique. And that was definitely the main reason I called you, is you have this talent of tying text to technique in a real concrete way.
And I think that is also connected to this trying to look at the skills and everything on one level up or one level down, depending on how you look at it, to see what's actually going on here with one human being standing facing a bunch of other people, and to always take it back to a more fundamental thing. We spoke about this when you visited me in Norway recently, this thing of, I almost use it as a technique when I'm talking to people about their work, to try to go more fundamental until you get to a point where you go, oh, now we understand each other. And this goes to this multidisciplinary approach that I had to have when I worked with Soiree for 12 years and was working as a sort of act doctor on all of the acts. And sometimes it's a singer, and sometimes it's a juggler, and sometimes it's somebody who's trying to work out how to do a whip cracking act within the confines of that show and everything. And with the show La Soiree or La Clique, when we were working on that and we were booking other acts, and Brett was contemplating who was going to, Brett Haylock, the producer of the show and creator, when he was deciding what to do, this initial structure that we had with the English gents doing a certain thing and my act doing a certain thing, and then David O'Meara's act doing a certain thing with the bathtub, then these things were certainly pins that we had dropped in the geography of what La Soiree could be. And you could swap those out with sometimes really quite odd kind of acts, because you found a certain quality that was above or below the actual skills that they did. Just the way that this person came out and the similarity of having Mario, Queen of the Circus, doing basically like stand-up for 3 or 4 minutes about just telling jokes and then doing a juggling act, that was oddly could be substituted with me doing the rackets. Strong characters who introduced some and then did some sort of skill with having, and you go, that quality early on, maybe after the gents when they had done their impressive stuff without talking, having somebody talk directly to you and bring them into the room, that there was qualities in those acts which would all of a sudden put like a physical comedy slapstick act in the same category of filling the same needs as a guy with a painted on mustache who talks about his love of Queen and juggling Queen music and of so that's another, that was a sort of example of that, and how being in Soray had that multidisciplinary approach where you have to find something beyond the skills to connect to the artist to be able to talk to so many different people with so many different skills.
Well, there you go. I mean, in La Soray, I mean, then there you go, you understand the effect those acts are having on the audience. And how do you even articulate that other kind of quality beyond the physical thing? It's so easy to say physically, oh, Frodo, you climb through 2 tennis rackets and you talk in a microphone. That's your act. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, on one level, that's your act. But like, that's not your act, right? And so I've developed, I think it's my juggler brain, is this idea of rhythm. So you figured out the rhythm of La Soirée and you say, oh, rhythmically, it goes for the audience on this kind of journey. And that's what I mean about Reflex in New York. When I went to do it 35 times in front of the audience, I suddenly started to understand, oh, we have created a rhythm here. We have created a show that's bigger than any one specific mechanical moment. I mean, physical moment of like, I have to juggle the balls here or the story is not going to make sense.
Yeah,
I definitely uncovered more like we opened with the opening act of the show. To give those expectations of, hey, that's what I think juggling is going to be. I went to see a juggling show. Yep, he's doing it.
That's right. So just recapping that, what we had in the very beginning, we sort of our short words for it was just call it the Vegas act. It was just super. It's your style, so it's not like a traditional Vegas act by any stretch, but your style and super high skill. Balls, clubs, and rings, and using the rings and balls and clubs also in some novel ways that is just highly unusual. But still, the overall idea with that opening act was that you were going to watch it and you were going to think, wow, yeah, that's juggling. That like, there's no doubt now anymore that this is a show about juggling and that you absolutely are a juggler. And that the other aspect that we wanted that act to have was that you would go, wow, he juggled the balls and the rings, and what's left? What goes on now?
Yeah.
So, and I remember you telling a great story of somebody who watched the show and with looking at it from a very arty point of view, somebody who's more interested in art.
Yeah.
High culture or whatever, and that they sort of went. Because you had a conversation with them afterwards, and they were like, okay, here we go. This is a juggling show. Oh, I'm in for this now for the rest of it. It's just going to be guy throwing stuff. And that then subverted it for the person who came for the art. That first act had that, and it confirmed everything that they think is wrong about circus versus opera or impressionist theater or whatever. And then that got subverted, and to the people who came, who were just like diehard fans of you and of juggling and your technical skill, they'd go, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. This is juggling. It's amazing. And it's like at the end of it, you go, hope there's more of that. And then they were also surprised because it took in another direction immediately afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of rules of thumb of that opening act when I was making it conceptually, which was really nice, was I'm going to throw and catch things. Like that was such a fun. I'm just going to throw and catch things. Like that's, I mean, fundamental, like overall, I'm going to basically be throwing and catching things because that's what people think juggling is. That was a nice rule of thumb. Again, it seems super obvious. Oh, you're a juggler. Of course you throw and catch things. Well, as you know, Frodo, in the creation process, I got a lot of stuff that's not throwing and catching stuff. And we talked about opening the show with those things. And that's the second rule of the opening act, which was people need to look at the opening act and say, that's juggling. Like, no question in your mind. You don't want them to, you don't want them to go to the juggling show. And in the rhythm we created, again, in the rhythm of the show we created.
Or structure, as I call it. When I'm talking on my podcast, I call it like it's the structure or the rhythm of the show. It's how, and you use those words too. It's the journey that the audience goes through. Yeah. What is it that we want to do? And in that structure, certainly, we wanted to start somewhere so that they knew where they were.
Yes.
Kind of.
Exactly. You didn't want them to come into the theater and say, hey, I bought a ticket to see a juggling show. The show's starting. Okay, what's this going to be? Probably because buying a ticket to a juggling show is not so normal. And then you start the show and they go, wait a second. Is that juggling? Wait, what is that supposed to be juggling?
Yeah, like, that was not juggling going to start or whatever. We wanted to like have that elephant in the room going, this is juggling. We know what it is. And then from that firm place of standing, we would leverage a whole lot of mileage because now we all go, well, this is juggling. And then comes the talking to reflect on that and to bring you into where the show would go.
And then the next thing that was really nice that worked was that we started off, we'd made a sketch of the show in June 2020, ran the show through, really didn't work. Oh, but we learned so much why it didn't work and where we maybe wanted to go, how to fix it. I mean, that's such a wonderful way to fix something is to fail. It's so great. Because it existed. We had that video, Frodo, of that show, and we could watch it back and forth and rewind it and, wait, why is this part terrible? Because we had a place to start the conversation from, and we could build the conversation on this failure. It was a concrete starting point. So I love that. And what we originally had was, well, after this opening act, we wanted to kind of really counterpoint it. Because that was very expected. It was very, like I said, people would think it was juggling. Oh, this is what I came to see. This is what I wanted to see, juggling. This is what I know juggling is. We really wanted to twist. So originally we wanted to, I think I was just telling about my life. Like, I started juggling when I was 8 years old and I grew up in Ohio. And it was all this stuff that I didn't care to tell you. I wasn't invested in that. I was not invested in those details. I did not care if you knew I juggled when I was 8 years old at that moment in the show. But I was still telling it because I thought that's what we should do, right? We had this assumption or whatever, this inclination, like, oh, maybe people want to hear like this. And then we watched that video through and we're like, this is terrible. Like, I hate this. And therefore, I think other people hate it too because I didn't care. Mm-hmm. So why should you care? And then we were like, oh, let's do the opposite. Let's totally like do the expected juggling act. And then let's go far out into outer space, like literally, and tell some crazy artistic, weird story to make people go like, I know what he's doing. He's juggling. I know who this guy is. And then all of a sudden, the next thing out of my mouth is I'm talking about like in outer space and the planets and whatever. And then we tried that as well. But then like you are often good at saying, we swung too far in the opposite direction, maybe, of where we should go. And it was too, you didn't have any connection to me. Like, I did this juggling act, and that's already alienating because the skill is this barrier of like, oh, here's this guy doing all these things I can't do. And I'm not a juggler, maybe, you know, so like watching this. So then, well, I don't know what to think about those things. Oh, it looks like he didn't mess up. Or like he caught them all. I don't know like how you can technically evaluate that. And hopefully it's fun. But there's really you don't really learn anything about me through watching that other than obviously I spent a lot of time practicing. And then to launch into this kind of outer space story straight away, it's like, because you're still trying to figure out what's the show going to be. You're still trying to figure out like, who am I watching? What are they going to do? Where is this going? Why should I care? Am I going to like this? Is this good? I don't know. And so watching in that outer space story was equally alienating where it's like, oh, wait, what? Now we're talking about outer space. This isn't what I signed up for. Like the journey was not very, accessible. It wasn't very sympathetic to the audience. So you just added like such a nice little thing there. You said, well, after the juggling, just tell them your name and say that you're a juggler. And it's so stupid. And in rehearsal, cause like you say, in these rehearsal rooms, when you're alone or with one other person, it feels so dumb. But man, in New York, Frodo, that like worked that was such a great device. And it became one of my favorite parts of the show because I would do this technical juggling act on the music and with the lights flashing and everything. And then I would get done, and then I could just hang in that moment of anticipation, which is my favorite thing to do on stage, I think. These moments of ambiguity where anything is possible and you don't know what's going to happen next, but you want to find out. That's like, that's my favorite thing to do in the world. That's why I perform. And so I'm hanging in this pause, you know, in this silence on stage after the opening act, and people are like, what's going to happen next? You know, and you can just sit there and breathe in that moment. And then you just say, hi, my name's Jay and I'm a juggler. And it's so completely stupidly casual and informal and a dumb thing to say. And the way I speak is so not pretentious, and it's just so completely, casual. It was really like, wait, and people just laughed, and it was so fun because you had just done this like completely intense, high energy thing with the juggling and all the tricks and all the props and all the music and all the lights. It was really building up this big thing, and then just to completely undermine that with this stupid like, hi, my name's Jay, and well, I'm a juggler. People are like,
yeah,
we just saw that. Why are you telling us? But then to switch, really, that was a nice transition into that outer space story. So it caught them unaware. They're like, oh, okay, this guy's just like you and me. He's a little bit, he's just speaking like, oh, his name's this, and he's just doing this thing. Oh, okay. I get what he's doing now. Again, they get it. But then to transition into the space story, that was one of the best moments of the show for me on stage, to feel that. We're giving a nice little roller coaster of expectations at the top of the show. So that really worked throughout all the shows. I think it was a fun moment.
I think it's also that when you start doing your skills at that level, it's intimidating. There's seven balls and five clubs, and it really is a barrage of impressions, and you don't know what to think. So after that, one way that you could go is like, I am a world champion. I was already, when I was 12 years old, I won the Golden Clown at the IJAA, the International Juggling Association's Long-Term Time Service Award, whatever. Like, so you just come out and you go on, and here are some cool video clips of me when I was on TV and I did this act. And so you, because you've demonstrated that you're a big deal or whatever, just with the skills, there's just the truth of skills that I always talk about. People just love seeing something done masterfully. It's just impressive in itself. And at that point, they will now wonder, like, how can we relate to this? They can't relate to the skills. The general public can't relate to what's going on. They don't know how to assess what it was. And then this, like you said, you just say, hi, my name is Jay and I'm a juggler. And it would just, people would burst out laughing, because it's almost, you've created almost this crazy illusion or something. And then you break through that and they calm down and they go, oh, it's like that. And it's kind of funny that we talk so much about something which sounds so inane, like just saying that, because it's not great writing, but it is extremely effective in that moment. And that was what happened both through when we practiced it in the space, and but also when we talked about it, is that we sort of, when you and me are talking about the show, I place myself into that space of the state of a show emerging between myself and the audience. I have done that so much in my life, and I embody myself into that in my imagination when I'm talking to you, and having to frame my thoughts to you as I am speaking is in a weird way similar to this state where I just have to let it unfold my thoughts in real time to you. That when I said that or whatever in some jam or whatever, that I just go, I think that will work because I now felt this situation, and maybe that will be enough to then go to then they go, oh, he's a real person. He's a normal. And after so many attempts at writing something which had hundreds of words and all sorts of stuff involved in it and autobiographical details, it's like you go, actually, if you just say that, that will have the effect of placing the audience in this mind frame. So when we then basically start talking about space, which is space and as a space exploration, that that is the kind of seed that's planted there, which will take you to the moment when you are almost inexplicably moved by a guy just juggling the cascade, the basic figure of eight, the infinity sign with three juggling balls that disintegrates. At the end, after that thread of technical skill and you as a person and that exploration of space, when that then comes together in the end, I think that's, I like to think of that first thing that we're about to deliver after the introduction of, hi, I'm Jay and I'm a juggler, that that's the seed of what will grow. They don't know it yet, so it will feel a little bit out of place, but every time that gets revisited, that thing grows in their mind and becomes what the show is actually about, and that the whole historical thing becomes the way that we kind of framed you and your exploration and your obsession with juggling or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about the text that in New York that I learned or kind of surprised me was this people believed what I said. Like, I could say something, I could say something and people would just accept it with no question. But I think that's also because I built some sort of trust, right? Like, we had a good rhythm or good structure at the beginning of the show to have them follow me. That's the only thing. You need to get the audience to follow you, and then you can take them anywhere you want because they're following you, because they want to have a good time. They want to like you. They want to relate to you. They don't want the show to suck. So, and you pointed out, because we had a phone call with Josh and Lindsay, Hideaway Circus, who produced the show, and with you and me, and we did a little decompression or whatever you call it, examination.
Deconstruction.
Yeah, whatever, of how the show went, reflection on the run. And one of the things you all said is that I have, even when I speak now, is I have this tendency to always have to validate a million different ways what I'm going to say. So I always try to anticipate what the questions are going to be, and I try to like close all those doors so that when I say the thing out of my mouth, that you're just going to believe me. And I don't think it has so much, I'm not such an insecure person, I don't think. I think it's my way of working out my thoughts in my head, and that's the way we worked on our process of writing the show. So a lot of those things were in the end left in the show at some point, where it was like I would say something to the audience, but in my head I'm like, well, if I say this statement, they might be thinking X, Y, and Z. I better deal with those potential thoughts. And then I would kind of underscore the point like four or five different times in a row, in a different angle of attack to try to validate the statement, you know? And what I found in New York was like, I could just say stuff the first time and people were just like, oh, okay, I believe that. Like, really much in the show where I would say something, you know, and then people would be like, well, that's not true. And then I would have to spend, you know, five more lines convincing them it was true. And so I mean, definitely the writing in the performance over the run of 35 shows, it just got edited like much tighter.
It's so interesting you say that, because I think that is all that to me is a feature of all first seasons. You go out with what you thought that was needed, and to be able to express yourself, you need a lot of words. But then when you go out there, you if you're an attentive performer, paying attention to what the audience, how they behave, and you can see it in their faces, and you go, oh, they already know this. I don't have to say anymore. I remember when I did the first version of what I did with my Waldorf ropes, when I talked about reality and that, there was a whole section in there which I realized this is a repetition. And I took literally like 50 seconds of text, took it out of the routine, and the routine remained the same in terms of the meaning of what I said. So you like go, oh, that whole section, I say it first and then I make one big sort of example, which on paper looks really good, but when I'm actually doing the magic and there is something happening real in the space, you don't have to do any qualifiers of to make another example of why it is like that. When you've said it one time, they just go, oh, okay, this is all I have ever thought about the relationship between doing rope magic and looking at the philosophy of what is truth. So you're just mixing these things together. So you're like, you just read the poem, no qualifiers, just let them sit there and enjoy it. And all those doors that you try to close off, all that does is that it they go, oh, those doors, but they will see some other doors and they will take those doors regardless of what you say. So just keeping it simple and letting the thoughts that the audience has that pops up. Because there was another thing that you spoke of. You went out and spoke to someone afterwards and they gave you their idea of what the show was about from their point of view. And it differed from what you thought the show was about, and you were like, oh, does it, should we alter it to be more about that or be more clear about what we do? And I'm like, well, I think the show, like a good poem, has actually many meanings, and the reason why it keeps feeling timeless and that it speaks to you even 100 years after that poem was written is that it gets to a truth which is so multifaceted that it fits all sorts of things into it. So yeah, I think that's I lost the thread there when I jumped on the side note, but that the show ended up being multifaceted and that you can't always close off enough doors to make it say only one thing. Because right. Even when you say something very simple like, please turn the heat up a little bit in the caravan here, because it's getting, just turn the heat up a little bit. And then if this is to your partner or whatever, it could be sort of antagonistic because it's your responsibility to have the heat, or it could just be a comment on the state that anything has multiple meanings and anything is pragmatic and has multiple. So it's and it takes the doing of the show to come to terms with what the show actually is and how much is needed. And it usually for me is that I need to say less and just but that process only comes through actually doing it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, not to repeat it, but that just, hi, my name is Jay, I'm a juggler. You know, it serves a function of a certain structure and a certain feeling. And those words just worked perfectly for the length of time and for the meaning we wanted to have there. And we did write so many words there before and trying to imagine that those would accomplish that thing. And that's one thing is also in the writing process. At first, I did write all of my dialogue, listening to your voice notes and editing the text we would try to craft. I would just write it down, and on paper, when you read it, man, it was really well. It was good. I did a good job of all those notes and incorporating everything, I think. For my first try, and then you know, reading those words out loud off the paper didn't work at all, right? Because it's just unnatural. The way you write and the way you speak is completely different. And then you said, oh, but Jay, you know, you should just speak the words out loud when you write them down. And I was like, yes, of course I'll do that. And so then I went through a whole process of that. And I was like, oh, man, now I figured it out. Like, I just have to speak as I write. And then it makes a lot of sense. But then I hadn't internalized the dialogue. I hadn't done it in the rhythm of the performance. I hadn't done it with the actual physical movements. Completely different again. And then getting to New York City in front of the audience, completely different again. So, and I don't know if that process could or should be streamlined. Maybe that is the process of things that they have to go through, that edit, you know, 4 or 5 stages of different editing to learn and to understand what you're actually trying to do. But that's that was definitely a big lesson or something I realized on this production. And then the other thing that talking about expectations there and like the function of what things actually do on stage. So sometimes it's not the literal words you're saying, it's just more the way you say it, right? It's just, it's more the intention of that moment. And so we had, after that big Vegas juggling act, we were like, oh, what's the next juggling they should see? And we'd done this kind of speaking expectations of who I am, but what should the juggling be? I don't know if you remember this, but then I remember the other week it was, we're going to do the ball bouncing machine. I jump rope with a ping pong ball, and because that's completely the opposite of throwing and catching. It's completely the opposite of what the audience thinks juggling would be, right? So if we'd have started with the ping pong ball, for sure people in the audience are like, wait, is this juggling? Because the machine's bouncing the ball, and it's only one ball. But I'm not even manipulating the ball. It's a machine doing it. And man, Frodo, that worked so good. It was so fun because we had established what juggling was, then we established who I was, and then the next image they saw was this completely different thing. It was such a nice counterpoint to all the throwing and catching in the opening act. And it really established a world between which the show could exist. We kind of established a set of boundaries within which we could explore then for the rest of the show. the rest of the show. And again, I could never have articulated that a year ago so clearly. I had an intuition of like, I looked at the list of stuff we could do in the show. And I said, okay, after the Vegas act, maybe we should do something completely opposite. And it was like ball bouncing machine. Oh, that's a good one. Because it's also concrete. The ball bouncing machine, even though it's abstract for juggling, it's a concrete action. It's not like I had a piece of cloth and I was just waving it around, where it was like an undefined technique of like, wait, what is he even doing? You're like, oh, it's a machine that bounces a ball, and he's jump rope, and it's a kind of a stupid thing. You jump rope the ball. It was funny. Man, people were so into it, Frodo. I was thinking of this stupid bouncing machine for years. I wanted this ball bouncing machine for years. And finally, our great friend Drew, who's like just a genius, he built this machine that bounces a ball on its own. And I had this little idea like, oh, I should jump rope. I don't know why. I just thought intuitively as an artist in my career, I was like, that's an image that could be kind of cool. But dude, it was a risk, Frodo. I never performed that machine before. We took it to New York and put it in this big show. And you know, that first dress rehearsal, like, I didn't know what was going to happen. I thought it was cool. Maybe you thought it was cool. I don't know.
I thought it was great, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, you don't know. People could have
watched. You just don't know. Yeah. But it is also that you get, we show them some physical skill, like your material, you juggle really hard, and then you introduce yourself in a casual way, and we turn it into a greater thing, which gives them you as a character.
Yeah.
Because once you started to talk about NASA and about your dad's connection to NASA and about space exploration and the greatest throw in the history of the universe of NASA being a juggler or whatever, once that's been set up, it also shows you on a really low level of who you are, like your name and your occupation. So we introduce, but then we also shows more the depth of how you think. And it's poetic and it's beautiful. So that also introduces the character some more. And then they trust you because of your skill, and they trust because of your right. honesty in how you express yourself, because you express those things. And when you talked about how to say it, that comes down to, for me, comes down to, is, does this feel authentic or not? And authentic is a difficult word, but for me it means when you get the feeling like the outward expression expresses something which genuinely comes from you, so that there is an accordance between your inner world and what's going on in the outer world. And once you had done that, they were ready to come with you. And that then that juxtaposition between the super high skill and now the bounce ball machine, they go like, and how little we spoke about that, because that's like, you know, in most shows you'd go, oh, this is a bounce ball machine and it was made like this and it's on this principle. But for having something which is so complex, a machine, and we chose to say not a single word about how this machine came into existence, and that there only is one in the world, kind of. It's a unique art creation of a machine that does the first step of juggling. It's juggling one ball or whatever. That was also kind of, I think, impressive, with that you take something which is such a rich and bizarre object or a machine, and then you use it in service of the text, which was by that stage pursuing the idea of like, what is juggling? How much can you take away and it still remains juggling or whatever? So
that's a nice little side note you just invented now. Like that would be really nice. That could totally work in the show, Frodo, and just say like,
what was that?
Just to go back and say like, but you know, let's get back to the fundamentals of juggling, because of course with juggling you start with one ball.
Oh, yeah.
That could totally work for the machine, too, for the context of the machine. Because the machine really did set up this next section where we could talk about what juggling was with the audience, and it was fun. I was really nervous we really worked on the script a lot, so I wasn't nervous that the script was going to suck. But, like, I was talking about the mechanics of juggling after that, like, a little bit. I mean, a little bit deeply. And I was really worried, like, oh, are people going to think it's a lecture? Are they going to think it's an educational program? Are they going to be bored by... No, it was so fun. They were very curious. Like, when I did the Newton's Cradles, man, people liked the Newton's Cradles, too. I was so happy. They were invested in it because we were talking. And what the technique we had kind of decided upon over the course of the creation was, you can't talk directly about the technique you're going to do. you know, you can't say, oh, and then I'm going to take a ball on two wires and transfer vertical movement into horizontal movement through the transference of energy, la, 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 and then do that trick with the Newton's cradles. Because the Newton's cradles say all of that through doing the Newton's cradles. You don't need to say it out loud with your mouth. You just need to do the trick. But what was really nice in a technique that we thought would work, and I think really worked well in the show, was saying something, not poetic or conceptual, but painting an image. First painting one image, and then demonstrating a technique, and having those two moments side by side in the audience's mind was really fun. I thought it was really working, and that was what we wanted to do. We were thinking, oh, okay, we can't talk directly about the juggling and then do the juggling. It's too repetitive.
Yeah.
But what if we could say something, you know, potentially personal or insightful about how to look at the world or the larger concepts that juggling deals with, and then do some specific juggling that really fits that juxtapose these two images next to each other, the talking and the juggling, and then that's going to say the whole thing. And yeah. I have to say that actually worked too. I'm surprised, but happy. I just never did it on stage before, so I'm full of like surprise at these moments. I'm like, wow, Frodo, do you know what? Like, you could do these things on stage like this, you know? Which is a lot what you do.
I think it's you set up something first that they then get invested in or just take in. And this helps becoming a lens, or this becomes the thing that you create the metaphor with. Because metaphor is like you apply one thing and see how it overlaps with something else. And the best metaphors are the ones that don't fully quite match. It's not a one-to-one, but it's also got to be not two totally different things. So by giving them that one little image beforehand that leads you into it or whatever, I think that's a valuable thing. But to the other thing where you go, oh, well, I was afraid that they were going, when they start talking about here's one ball, here's two balls or whatever, like some juggling mechanics. What I felt at that point also was that if we have them in the right place now, then we will have them feeling like you are building an argument, that you're introducing them to several different things. And hopefully, like in the beginning, they don't know that it's going to go somewhere. But as the show starts to take shape, they will begin to see the structure, how the thing starts to regress they start to go back on themselves and go come out again in a further stage forward or whatever. And like you're building an argument in a poetic kind of way where it the show is building momentum or so.
Yeah. So,
and I'm glad to hear that they got that. They're listening to you explaining about one ball or whatever, because they now have seen something and they get the feeling almost like you're giving them some a glimpse into how the magic was made or how the cake was made. Yeah.
There's a couple of challenges that I wasn't all good. Like, now I've just been like, this part worked good. This part worked good. There was a couple of things I encountered that were harder and not working as good. And I could talk about that. Was that, so after this kind of section, you know, we're going chronologically through the show. So kind of the next thing that happened, that like after the Newton's cradles, let's say, was I did this kind of street show moment, where I do a call and response with the audience. I kind of turn into a new energy, into a new way to talk a little bit, and a new attitude, and I directly confront the audience like in a street show, and I actively invite, you know, response, like, you know, for them to talk back to me in this conversation, like literal conversation. That worked good. Like the rhythm or the feeling of like turn, like now we're into a new, you know, attitude. Like that was really cool. I think it really pumped up the feeling, the energy of the show there. That was awesome. The street show, a little bit more confrontational and definitely talking directly to the audience. The thing that sometimes didn't work, it was very inconsistent, was I wasn't able to be funny sometimes. The street show would start off with like very declarative statements. Normally it would say like, I'm better than you. And my, you know, half the times that would go really well and people would be like, ha, like they, you know, it's quite a pretentious or egotistical state, but we don't normally talk like that in polite conversation like that. And that also wasn't my demeanor the whole show until then. So it was definitely a break of character, and it was a little bit of a confrontation. And many times it would lighten the mood and get us into the street show. And I could say a bunch of these declarative things like, I'm better than you, I'm good and you're bad, and la la la. And then we get into this little fight, and we set up a game basically. And I'd say half of the shows that went fine. But there were other nights when I would come out and I'd say, and I'm better than you. And the audience would just be like, yep, okay, I believe you. Going back to that thing of like, I can say whatever I want and they believe me, because from the beginning of the show, we set up, I'm being casual and chill. And then it kind of goes into this more conceptual place. Oh, so this guy is also kind of funny, thinks a little bit funny. And he's just, and I'm just making declarative statements, like very factual statements. And then when we get to this, when we get to the street show, and then the next fact out of my mouth is like, you know, I'm good and you're bad. Right. Which on the surface is true at juggling generally for that audience. But on the other hand, clearly theatrically, I'm trying to play it into a new kind of attitude. And so this happened at a couple other places in the show where the reaction every night would kind of not be consistent. And that kind of drove me nuts. And maybe that's just because I'm too old to deal with that. No, but it's more like if there was an inconsistent reaction in the show, for me, it pointed at I did a bad job at writing that moment. And I would have to kind of sell it by some sort of unconscious means to kind of ham it up or to enhance what I had actually written to make it work. And I've been in shows before where there's been really, I'm sorry, but really bad directors. And they made really bad choreography and bad content. And I was on the ensemble, and it was up to me to go on stage and sell the audience these bad ideas. And the thing of those moments that hurt wasn't that the idea was bad or I had to sell it, is that I knew that if I gave 110%, Frodo, if I killed myself on stage and bled out my heart, the best I could hope for in that moment was for the audience to go, oh, that was pretty cool. Like, I couldn't make them cry. I couldn't make them scream, right? Because the writing of the show wasn't, it was a structural problem. And so getting into the street show, I don't think was maybe a structural problem in and of itself. The structural problem maybe was earlier in our show, where I didn't allow the audience to see me in different ways. Like, I kind of put myself on too narrow of a track, right? Mm. So by the time I got the street show, I was just too defined. And I couldn't break out of it some nights.
Right? It's interesting you say that. When I was writing a note, I would know what I thought when you were saying it. And I said, It's like by the time you deliver a line in a show, particularly when you've already done some shows or whatever, and you kind of know what the show is, if it failed in that moment, it is rarely because of what you did in that exact moment. It's at fault. The fault lies somewhere in what led up to it. So that this moment now, for whatever reason, your inner truth does not shine through into your, and very often it is that thing that you have narrowed yourself down. You become so confident in the text or whatever that some of this, the many different aspects of you, like you say, like that you are a human being that sometimes do something really impressive and then you say something that's actually kind of silly and goofy or whatever. But if you just deliver yourself as in, here, I did that incredible thing, and here's this machine that bounces a ball, and I'm juggling the Newton's cradle, so you keep being impressive and keep talking about science and reality and NASA, and they just bowled over. They don't know how to insert themselves into any of it. And that's always a danger when you're just giving so much. And that's also why the street show, what we can shorthand call the street show, was you're genuinely inviting them into a response. And while that was introducing a new energy that hadn't been there before, and you're working hard to find a place for them to literally insert themselves into the show by getting them to a certain point so that they actually start to respond, and then a new game and a whole new thing starts. But by that stage, you do run the risk of becoming like godlike or untouchable, because you're saying all sorts of impressive things using sciencey words and using emotional words and using almost that they don't know what to think about it.
Yeah, you're on the edge of just alienating the audience, basically. I mean, like, I think I took
I don't. Maybe, but I don't know if it's that you alienate them, but it's that there is no room for them to insert themselves into it. So when you all of a sudden surprisingly want them to take part, they don't know. They go, obviously, I can't just say, do one more ball. Can you juggle five? Because it's some guys up there talking about quantum theory, and then you just go like, yeah, but have you ever considered doing one more? What happens if you add one more number in your equation, Mr. Professor? Like, and you just feel like
maybe it's not alienating. Maybe it's more like they're slightly disconnected, right? Like somebody's just making a bunch of statements and you're like, yep, yep, okay, I hear you, I hear you. And you can just start to lean back, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You become just, you realize I am just being talked at here.
Exactly.
There's no room for me to actually participate and beyond giving my time and attention.
The good thing of the venue was it only seated comfortably about 40 people. I mean, you could squeeze about 55 in there, but it was like really tight. So you're in basically a living room situation. I mean, it's literally like you got 40 people on top of you. I mean, it was a real intimate place. So this talking directly to the audience many times, I mean, I had a lot of feedback actually on that from the whole show. After I would do a performance, people would say, I was so shocked. I went to see the show and he looked right at me and talked like to my face. And it's like, yeah, there's 40 people and you're right here and I'm talking. So I'm not going to pretend that I'm in Carnegie Hall and like into the void, staring off into the distance of delivering these lines. I was like, no, I'm actually talking to people. So obviously there in the street show, that really helped too. Cause even though I didn't set it up earlier in the script, maybe good enough that I could be funny or I could be sad or I could be different things. I was still talking directly to people before the street show. It's just the street show was the first moment where, I wanted to be a little bit provocative or poke at them a little bit of that relationship and that trust in that moment, and then turn it into where they can talk back to me. And we have this little lesson lesson again sounds so pedagogical, but like it was a fun little moment, I thought. I mean, in the end, the street show really worked. And I could say, I just wanted to say this as a little like reflection on whatever I'm performing, Frodo, but like we had this idea in the street show that they're going to ask me to do one more and do one more and do one more. And we had this verbal prompt of like, I would tell them what to say. But I told them the game at the beginning. I said, well, I'm better than you, but you can always beat me because you can just tell me to do one more and you'll always win the game by just telling me to do more. And it was so funny. Every single show, the adults would just yell out one more. So if I would do four, they would say five. If I did six, they'd say seven. But it was always the kids, which was so actually funny. The first time they would yell out, they would just yell out, do a million. Like they instantly got the game. And it was
get the game and upped it. Yeah, that's so cool.
Yeah, like they instantly just like understood the concept of like, I'm going to beat this guy. I'm not going to tell him to do five if he's doing four. I'm going to tell him to do a million. Like,
yeah. And boom, you just lost on the first call.
And that was the coolest part, because I think a lot of people in the audience sometimes were like, to the kids, they were like, oh, that kid yelled out a million. That's so stupid. But actually, that was the best thing, right?
Because
the whole point of the scene was to show that like how fragile this traditional way to present juggling is. Mm. So when the kids would yell out, juggle a million, I was like, oh my goodness, thank you. Like, so that would also be a fun thing. I wonder if we could work on in the script in the future. Like, how could we entice the adults to also kind of like presuppose, you know what I mean? Like kind of, it was fun though. It was a really fun way that the kids just got to the point and really strengthened the show by kind of messing it up. But like, that's intentionally there to mess up. That's the whole point of the scene. But there was another point in the show too, where I was getting an inconsistent reaction every show. Like some of the shows it was fine, some of the other shows it wasn't like landing as good as it should or like settling down at the conclusion of the Kara boxes. And so I missed you in New York, man. Like you weren't there. So I was stuck on my own. Totally missed you. But my tactic there, which I think in the moment worked, was so after a couple of weeks or maybe a week and a half, I changed the script there. And at the end of the Kara boxes, I was making the scene about the audience. So I would kind of end with the text going outwards to the audience, and I changed it. So at the end of the scene, it was about me, because I figured I can act the same every night. Like I can have the consistent reaction every night, right? Instead of, because it's like that thing when you're on stage, you sometimes don't want to ask the audience a question because you don't know what they're going to say. Like yes, how many street shows, like real street shows have you seen or other shows? And they go, are you guys having fun? And it's like dead silent, you know, or do you want to see some more? And like dead silent or no, I don't or whatever. So it was a little bit like that. Like at the end of the care boxes, I made a little joke and sometimes it would get a little laugh. And sometimes people would just, again, be a little bit like, oh, he just said a thing. Like, and it wasn't really like funny or whatever, or connecting with them so significantly. It was always a little bit like, eh, it's okay. But then I just turned the text around so it was about me at the end every time. And I could be enthusiastic about, and I liked the new text. I ended up changing the text to being about juggling is somewhere between juggling the planets and juggling molecules. And like, we have this spectrum of everything in the world can be juggling. And I kind of had this little game I played with myself in that moment and had this little twist on the text that I thought was really fun to deliver. So I, again, I had conviction in that moment and I could really sell the structure of that moment. And that, again, maybe it's not the perfect solution, or maybe there's a million other solutions that can be stronger in connecting other things. But I was really happy of discovering that tactic of like taking it off of the reaction off of the audience and putting it onto me. And that actually, in the end, people did laugh then, like kind of every time, because I would get so excited and say this totally ridiculous kind of conceptual thing about juggling planets and molecules and la la la. And then they would always be like, whoa, like that's kind of a far out, like Jay's a little bit crazy there or whatever. It was consistent then, at least. And I don't know, that made me feel good. This do you ever encounter this idea of consistency in your act of like having to, you come in, like I have a piece in a, like in the tennis rackets, and if I don't put this energy into it, it couldn't go good, or you have everything locked down.
Yeah, well, the tennis has just been done so many times that I've failed all those things, and some of those things I failed a decade ago, so I've sort of forgotten why it was ever any other way. That often is the way when you've done something. The difference between when you had done just the first showing and you had done the 6 showings, and now that you've done the first season, each time you start to see and learn more and more what it is that you actually have, and you will iron out those kinks, and that little thing you say earlier will now perfectly line up with the thing that you do next. And this process of turning it around on yourself to go, now it's on about me, which was something about you pouring tea into a cup, and that this was now, I just juggled a million billion
juggles, the molecules from the pot into the cup. I juggled them. Yeah.
And it's, so this was also like, this was the second kind of time when we get back to the seed of juggling being a metaphor for absolutely everything, kind of. Outer space and inner space and microscopic space.
Exactly. So. And so then there was another, so between the audience run throughs, just to wrap up this little arc of like problems in the show that I discovered, between the 6 or 7 audience shows in December and then going to New York City, I totally rewrote the end of the first section of the show over Christmas.
That's right. I remember that was at the end of it, there was the one thing that people were questioning what was going on, and we were then questioning, and there was something wrong with the structure of how it was told, because there was, as far as I remember, too much information put into too short a time, but we really needed to wrap that up now to get into the next section. But like in any good detective novel or whatever, when you're going to wrap everything up in one chapter, and it's going to feel both inevitable and surprising and exciting, then the words have to be just right. And I remember you did all of this, and this was like all on your own, and I really like what you did with it. It was great.
Well, so that's the funny thing, is like I think I accidentally, I mean, it was definitely through conversations with you that I got the idea to do it like that, but like I accidentally stumbled onto something that worked really well. I'll tell you what that is, but I picked a mechanical device of text, of like structuring the text based upon, I thought I was doing something else, and then in the end it turned out I was doing something much bigger. So I want to tell you about that. So basically, I had too much information to tell in too short of a time. So the audience had a hard time of following me. And one of the feedback things I got was actually from my wife. And she said, like, well, after that opening Vegas act, you just start talking and you just don't stop. And we don't know if it's ever going to stop. Like, we don't know when you're going to stop.
It's going to go for 1 million years.
Yeah. So at the end of this, that first speaking section, before we dive into the next chunk of the show, which is all juggling, which was our intentional way of how we wanted to format the whole show. We had this idea of talking about the juggling and then doing the juggling so that when I finally get to do it, you have a new understanding of it. That was our whole goal of the structure of the show, the format.
Interspersed with small, sometimes just like 25, 30 seconds, 1 minute at the most of juggling. But you would feel like these things were there to illuminate and bring clarity to certain things you were talking about.
Right. So I thought about what my wife said, like, we don't know if it's ever going to end. And like, it's really hard to concentrate, especially doing the shows here in Sweden, where all of my audiences were not native English speakers. Everybody here speaks English or a million other different languages, actually. But English isn't their first language. So when I was delivering, especially at the end of having talked for a long time, and then the end of that talk was the most intense talking, it was exhausting for them to try to like mentally, because I was just talking more and more and more and more and more. And it's just more and more concentration, and you did just get tired. So I thought, oh, I just stumbled onto this idea of like, okay, I'm going to tell them it's the end. I'm going to tell them what to expect. And so basically I had three main points in that ending speech. And so I just said, before I said it, I said, I'm going to tell you the last thing. Right. So that was already letting people go, okay, I just have to listen to one more thing and I have to get the energy up for that. Yep, and, you know, and then I said, I'm going to tell you the last thing. It's in three parts. And part one is this. And then I would tell the part one. And when I was done, I would literally say, part two is this. And then I'd say that. And then finally, part three. And just by dumb luck of trying to fix that moment in the show, I think I kind of fixed the entire first section of the show. Because that was, because you pointed this out a couple of weeks ago, that's the first point in the show where I'm speaking on a meta layer about what's happening on the action of the show, right? Like everything else in the show so far I've been speaking on a very linear level, and now all of a sudden I'm making these little comments, these little asides about like, I have one more thing to tell you. That's like, you know, you're in a movie and you break the fourth wall and look at the camera and then do a take there, right? So kind of by trying to solve the organization of all that information I had to deliver, I actually, in the bigger picture, did a better job of giving an arc to the whole first section of the show, which, looking back on it, thank goodness I did, because I think that really, really worked, of saying, okay, now acknowledging I've been talking a lot, and you saw me juggle at the beginning of the show. So that was going back to that expectation we set up. People come to see a juggling show. I do this Las Vegas act. That's what people think they're going to see. They don't think they're going to come see someone talk for 20 minutes. So if we would have just started with the talking, that would be weird too. People would be like, wait, I thought I saw there's a juggling show and he's just talking about juggling. He's not actually juggling. But we set up this expectation. We acknowledge some expectation of I'm going to juggle. So I do this Vegas act for 5 minutes, but then I talk for 20 minutes. And so rhythmically, the audience can also be going like, man, I thought, so he's not going to juggle anymore. Like, he's just going to talk for an hour. But then giving them that cue and saying, this is the last thing I'm going to say, and then I'm going to start juggling again. And then it's in three parts, and here's the part one and part two and part three. And, you know, rhythmically, these three parts is a real natural rhythm. And then that went into the next part of the show really well. And I think now, like we talked about this, when I was in Norway now, but like, we can clean up what we want those three points to be. That's kind of neither here nor there. But the structure, I think, or that device of having a meta commentary on helping the audience at that point in the show was a really nice way to also wrap up the talking and go into the juggling in a natural way. Because I think that could have also been really weird that I did just talk for 20. I mean, it was weird in December, right? Like, it wasn't entirely just flow easily. Yeah.
But it is, it's also one of those things that is done when you're doing nonfiction writing, or you see it in people who are doing corporate talks in particular. Like, you don't see it so well if you're watching a university style lecture or whatever, where they just go, I have this story to tell you, and then they just tell you the story and you just come along for the ride. But if it's a more sort of commercial kind of talk, they might go, all right, so I'm going to give you here five different points that you can use yourself to become more creative. So I'm going to do this first. There's going to be five different things. But before we get onto those five very practical things you can do, I'm just going to set the groundwork. This is the groundwork. And they're talking and they're going, oh, and then now we're going to do the next things. So this is a little bit also like what you do in the street show, where I used to do in my street show back in the ancient times, where I was like, oh, now I'm going to, in the end of this show, I, Captain Frodo, will be escaping from 5 meters of solid stainless steel chain and this hair straitjacket. But before we do that, I'm just going to show you a couple of incredible things that you won't believe that I can do with my body that allows me to most of the time be able to get out of this great challenge that we're going to have an escape thing in the end. And right. Those two things were just two things I pointed out from doing the tennis rackets. So this gives the audience the structure of it, so that when I then hold up the straitjacket before the second act, before the rackets is finished and someone's holding them already in the, it's woven together. They know that now that we're in there, because this is the first of those things that I mentioned. This is the second one of those things. It's the thing I can do with my, dislocate my body. And then we get into the straitjacket, and now we're going to see if those two things actually do manage to help me or whatever, which is why you have to tie it super tight and whatever. So to impose that kind of structure, it makes it more manageable. And I guess that's maybe one of the things that we didn't explicitly add in until you discover it there towards the end, to just like, because we had already said that most of the information, or if we can, all of the information in the show that was going to hand it, come across, was told through stories about you and never about when one juggles n plus one, and like, and not tell it to you in a theoretical way, but sort of tell it through a story of how you first thought of that thing or whatever. So you just show you getting the idea or whatever, which turned out to be a brilliant way of telling it. But maybe then with that overall first sort of section where the majority of the talking was, that we needed to just let the audience know that this is not just a whole bunch of random speaking. All of this is tying up to a point. So right. It was great. And that's a really good thing to bring along. And part of what you, when you talked about, oh, it's like we've made this framework for a show. And we did, because that, all of that information in the beginning could be swapped and still follow the same structure of how to present the material. And it will probably still work, even if you didn't talk, because the main focus of that section, which we haven't said, is the exploration of what the art of juggling actually is, or was it actually juggling first, or when did juggling become an art form, and what do we mean by that? And since those topics are just unbelievably vast, to start to talk about what art is often a lecture in itself, and start talking about what juggling is, art or entertainment or anything else, is also a sequence of lectures, which you do have a whole season of podcasts about that. So we basically had wrapping those three things up whilst introducing new characters, like the specific jugglers that brought juggling from entertainment into art, and to bring all of that up. That was the, when we mean we had too much information to give in too short time, that was the enormity of issues that we'd set up. So this frame really worked well at concretizing those.
Yeah, and to do a little work right now, like in real time. I mean, that first section, we could sum it up in one way and say it was about, traditionally juggling was about skill, difficulty, and risk.
Yep.
And we were basically in the first section setting that up, and then asking the question to the audience, what happens when you get, then you go beyond skill, difficulty, and risk, what is left?
Mm-hmm. That was the rest. Can it still remain juggling if the skill comes at least almost invisible, and there is no risk because you can't drop, and skill, and it doesn't appear difficult or whatever.
Yeah, if you don't judge it by how difficult it is, how can you judge it, and can you care about it? And that was kind of, that's a very concise way of articulating this year and a half where we really tried to find what was that first section about. And looking back on it, I think that is a nice way to maybe streamline our thoughts about what we're actually doing. Because it's not.
But in the meanwhile,
No, it's not.
That the story there is told through a guy losing his leg and using the money to write the first and most important book on the history of juggling and blah, blah, blah. So this was just huge things to go in, whilst actually what we were saying could be done really quite simple through this essence. But you were even talking about how you were realizing that the biggest omission was just that at the end of all of that, to wrap it back, not to, and that was the moment that juggling became art. I mean, you didn't say that, but like, that's kind of the paraphrasing of that.
Yeah.
You pin it down to a specific moment or whatever. And instead to go, and that's when it sort of transcended this game that we set up in the street show of the can you do one more, or what's the juggling, what's the difficulty, risk and skill involved, and that maybe we could totally transform that section to conform more to a little bit less intellect, because it doesn't get more intellectual than trying to define something as to whether it is art or not. But that reflected also the intense discussions that we had about juggling and the nature of juggling and what it is, and me about showmanship and what these things are. So we could almost not see that these things are, because we did manage to make it concrete, and the great responses that people tweeted and that people going, we were killing it with like what Teller is saying about the audience, like treat the audience like they're smarter than you.
Yes.
And you don't want to treat people like what they actually are, because then as human beings, they're just on this downward slope already. Treat them the way that they could be, or that, and having that in mind is probably reflecting on what Penn and Teller does as an art duo.
Yeah.
And lifting the whole level of what magic can be. And we spoke to the people like they would follow us along on these things. And we did very specific things with juggling skills as well that would keep you and know what we're talking about, and constantly making it concrete through your genuine travel through the world and your life and your biography of how you made these discoveries. But still, we could probably tone down that level and talk like just specifically, because those are all like we set those things up in one of the early stories of where you juggled for the launch of Viagra, which got completely cut because of all sorts of other reasons or whatever. But that just this whole thing of skill, difficulty and risk is a huge enough topic and enough of a shorthand for, is there something more to juggling if you go beyond the tricks or skill, difficulty, risk, which there is. And which is why the immediate aftermath of all of this talking is you doing the magnet clubs, which to me was all just leading towards you juggling three sticks that are tied together in one end in one of the most creative explorations of what juggling three objects can be. And that raises so many questions as to, is what I am watching juggling? And just hearing again here now from Nalle, when I was in Sweden doing a gig the other week, how he sort of basically said back to me what you and me had spoken about. We just want them, when you do that thing, for them not to feel like this is completely abstract, and not to ask whether it was juggling, but to look at what happens when you take away skill, difficulty and risk or whatever. So like, he didn't say it in those words, but I was just going like, it's there. Even when we feel like we might have gone too far in these things, and we can simplify it and still leave people feeling very smart and that they can, that they get it. We're not dumbing it down, but just simplifying the words that we use and the things we used to set this up. And it will make the aha moment when they go, oh man, yes, look at that. This also is juggling, to have that in there, that might feel, become more visceral to them when it's not so intellectual or whatever.
I mean, that's a good point. I should, for the sake of thoroughness, and like, we're recording this today as much as for ourselves as anyone else, for sure. So I should definitely
say this devolved into a little what we're going to do to improve on that show.
but it's good to uncover. I mean, there was so many. I mean, 99% of what happened in New York was just incredibly magical and perfect, man. Like, it was beyond, the process has been beyond my wildest dreams. And the run itself was just artistically, like, yeah, people would cry every night and stand up. Like, what? Like, I could never. Anyway. So,
which is interesting, too, in a 40-seater. It's not like they were just doing it because everybody else was doing it. Or like, it's
no,
not.
No.
It's a personal choice. The crowd up into Yeah.
Well, so, you know, like I say, all these wonderful things happen, and then uncovering a few of the things that didn't work perfectly. I have no regrets from February when the run was, except for one thing. Like, I wouldn't have really changed anything in February. Like, it was great, man. Like, this show worked. I did 35 shows. It never fell apart. It never fell down. We even did like a 10 a.m. show, and we were doing three shows a day and stuff. And I lost my voice. Even the show I lost my voice was, it worked. Like, it was never, I don't think anybody ever left the theater going like, oh man, like maybe they didn't like the show, but I don't think they were like, oh man, that had potential to be good. And it just fell apart. I think, you know, if people didn't like it, they're like, well, he did his thing, you know, I don't think, whatever. So, but there was one thing I would have changed and looking back on it, because it's so funny what it was. It's because at the end of that whole first section where I talk and I say part one, part two, part three, I lead the entire audience up to the edge of our argument. I lead them up to the highest pinnacle of the mountain of what we're talking about. I build this, like I say, we're building this argument, right? And I take them all the way to the top, and I just don't push them off into the over the cliff, like with me. Like, I jump, but I don't, I think they follow me because I think the show worked, but I could have just, for me, everything was so fundamentally, I had these assumptions. Like, I you go to juggling school, wrapping it back to that stupid thing. And now it's the first day of juggling school, we're going to juggle. It's like, no, hold on. We have to prepare to juggle. Like, you're already beyond the starting point because you're too deep in. And as for me, it was the same thing in the show. I was too deep into these things in my life, not in the show, in my life. It was so fundamentally a part of me that I didn't even think to say it out loud. So we build up this huge argument to the very end of the talking that first talking section. Everybody's there with me. And I said something like, now we're at the start of something, like, we're no longer at the end of something ancient from thousands of years ago. Suddenly we're at the start of something new that's happening right now. And for me, there was it made perfect sense. Like, everything inside of me, that everything I said there was perfectly expressed. But then looking back on it, I had set everything up to make sense. It's like I had told a joke and I just didn't tell the punchline. Because for me, the joke is the punchline is so obvious. So, like, I had been like, and so why did the chicken cross the road? And then I would just keep going on because it's so obvious it was to get to the other side that people would just have understood that. So, but it's so stupid because we did such a good job of crafting those arguments and setting up the whole situation. And I just didn't. I could have added like one or two sentences to just sum up the entire thing for everybody so concretely. And I kind of wish I would have done, or I wish I would have realized that like back when I was doing the run, at least on the last show or something. But
to be specific, like what would you say roughly?
Exactly. So instead of just saying like.
No, but if you were to, now, like if you I'm were to craft it now.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so.
That's good. So don't leave this as well, just as if we all know.
Hey, but it's so nice to talk to you. So take care.
We'll leave you at that. It's so obvious what it should have been. So yeah, I mean, won't even say it now.
so basically saying, you know, I'm no longer at the end of something ancient. I'm at the start of something that's happening right now, that's brand new happening right now. And so what if juggling isn't valued for skill, difficulty, and risk? What's left then? Like, I could have just said that.
Something like that. Yeah, exactly. That's really good.
But that's literally what I was implying.
Yeah.
And it was what was inside of me, and it was what was in the show, but I didn't say it out of my mouth because I thought it was so obvious. And that's also a good lesson I learned. I learned that when I was on stage, the audience believed what I said, like, very easily. I could have come on stage and said, hi, my name's Frank and I'm a juggler. And people would be like, oh, that's Frank. Like, they could have believed me. I can say my name is anything, you know? And so the same thing here. I can say like, I learned that I could say whatever I wanted and people would believe me. But I also learned that, like, I learned through this whole process, Frodo, that, you know, working with me on the show for all those months, that I'm bad at just saying basic things. I'm bad at articulating basic premises. Like I keep them in my mind and I'm thinking too far ahead all the time. Mm. I'm not saying I'm better or smarter at all. It's the opposite. I take too much for granted. And so even though I can say anything on stage and people can believe me, I still need to start at a more common ground. Like I need to judge where I'm speaking from more accurately, more realistically. And so I was just saying all these things about art and Michael Motion and where juggling's going in the future, but I forgot to take the step back and go, oh yeah, wait, we're having a conversation here. It's not me having a monologue. And so I think in that moment I did speak a little bit past my turn. But hey, out of a whole run to have one moment of looking back and go, oh, I wish I would have. That's, I'll take that. Like, that's not bad.
Yeah, yeah. And and it's also what was good is like it was left. We wanted it to be a little open as well. Like, keep talking about this room for the audience to insert themselves into it. And right. This was what you were talking about. But from what you did immediately afterwards, I think we still left it open. And you would have wanted to be more concrete or whatever, but it's also like, yeah, no, I totally get you. I think that's a great idea, and we could tone certain things down with to maximize the impact by not having so many threads to tie up.
Sure.
But the fact that people still saw it and it blew their mind, so that they intellectually afterwards, when they were trying to sum up what it was that they'd seen, it was like we were getting all sorts of different results, but all of them very engaged in what they had seen. And also then whether they came to see a juggling show, hardcore skills, or they came to see just a theater show or whatever, there was stuff in there that moved them either way. So right. That was impressive. And I mean, seeing it too, I remember I watched one of the later, or maybe it wasn't one of the later, but I watched one of the live streams of the show, and finding myself enough removed, because by that stage it had been like 5 weeks or something since I saw, 6 weeks or something since I was in Sweden or whatever.
Yeah.
And finding myself moved to tears by that moment. Like, and to when you see the whole thing in one long session and going like, it is surprisingly meaningful. And that beautiful last image where juggling the balls that dissipates in confetti and in ribbons that falls down of, and you've said so much, you've shown so much, and then to give it now the metaphor is so strong, because all that stuff that you've said about juggling and everything leading up and the beyond difficulty, skill and risk, and the NASA story gets tied up with NASA being the greatest juggler or and you've gone from the microscopic and the real concrete to now just this one last image. And at that point, when you're left then for 3.5 minutes or so, beautiful piece of music and you juggling, and it's the same image with the balls that are deteriorating as you juggle, you're left to have all of those things that you have seen and heard and that's just pushed you. It just starts to sink in. And as the balls literally vanish in front of your eyes, and it goes from having this figure of eight infinity sign in your hands, which so easily can become cheesy or whatever, like as you just stand there and you watch it, and it's just one simple image that keeps giving these flashes of the stuff that the balls are made up of as they deteriorate, you get the weight of everything that's been said. And like, you don't even know exactly why anymore, but it becomes so emotional. And this is that thing of like, you've laid yourself bare here with like, there is no greater declaration of how much of a nerd you are when you dedicate your life and you go and knock on the door of a obscure German juggling historian, and you, all those stories that you've told, that sums it up. But then you paint this enormously big picture in the end of the universe, and then just juggle in the simplest shape for 3.5 minutes, yet it's changing. It's like, it was, I mean, beyond what I had dared to hope for.
Likewise. So
it's still translated in watching it streaming on my computer,
yeah,
at home at an odd point in the day to make it fit with the streaming schedule.
Yeah, that's powerful. Yeah, I hear you. I mean, that was another thing that we stumbled onto that was way more clever than we first anticipated, which was to have that last image being 3.5-4 minutes long, that to sit there and have that time to reflect on all the material we had presented, which was a lot. I mean, admittedly, maybe too much, right? Like, it was just so much stuff in the show. We just crammed my life's work into a show. But then to end it with like 3 minutes or 4 minutes where you can just sit there and kind of like breathe and take in everything that was crammed into your brain was kind of more smart than we intended it for it to be. But like, it was awesome, right? Like that.
Yeah.
It was a double-edged kind of benefit. Like, we were looking at it again in a short term, like, oh, let's put those balls there at the end of the show. We're kind of looking at the end of the show, and we're not looking necessarily at the whole arc of the show, but looking at the whole arc of the show, it was a really great move to have those at the end of the show, just, you know, even maybe better than the reason to have them for in the immediate moment. And just to wrap up that thing on structure, I just wanted to say a couple of things more, just so we'll have the whole thing for us. You know, after that talking section with part 1, 2, 3, and then I go into this another juggling section, which was roughly the same time as the talking section, so it mirrored the rhythm there. So it's like I talk for 20 minutes and I juggle for 20 minutes. After that 20 minutes of juggling, which was an exploration of all the new ideas then, that beyond skill, difficulty, risk, one of those being musical juggling, and that was so immediate for the audience to understand. So that was a really good intuition to put that there, because what can there be to care about besides skill, difficulty? For example, I start doing the musical juggling. Nobody's like, oh, that's cool, he's making music with juggling, but he's only using 3 balls. And I know he can juggle 4 because he did 4 in the opening act, right? Like, that was such a perfect example, concrete example of like, people were into juggling. Why are you into the juggling? Because I'm doing 3? No, because you're making sound. Oh, you're focusing on the sound. Well, that's not about skill, difficulty, or risk, is it?
Yeah. And it becomes, because you said the words about Michael Motion when he did the triangle, nobody in that audience, when he unveiled that for the first time, said, oh man, that's cool, but can you do 4?
4, yeah.
Yeah, just don't. And when you're doing your data machine, all those machine, funny noise-making machines, analog-looking things, when that's activated by the juggling, nobody goes, can you do 4? Because you too have changed that conversation. It's not about that anymore. And nobody thinks it, because they're just exploring the universe. And when that comes after the you juggle the sticks, which is like what we kept using as the kind of litmus test of the one that's furthest away from difficulty, skill, and risk.
Yep.
Is this even, because there we don't know if you dropped all 3 sticks, even though they were tied together, they might see that as a failure of a break of that thing, but that's very abstract. But with the data machines, when you're literally doing like rhythms, they will see that thing was, or like they will have a different, so, but it doesn't become about that anymore. The fact that the skill is really high all the way through, which you might not even notice anymore.
I think it is
a risk to fail, but it has now become just like, there's always the risk that, oh, I wonder if the guy that's going to play the piano, if he's going to make a mistake when he gets to the second movement.
I forget
that somebody is playing, and you just get into the music.
I think that's a great point. I think that totally happened, and we hadn't said that clearly as you just did right now. So that's good. I totally agree. That was a really good feeling. But the cool thing I was going to say is, after that arc of that 20 minutes of juggling there, I get back to speaking again. And that was also a fun thing, because it was a familiar area for both me and the audience, because they've heard me speak for 20 minutes, but then I didn't speak for 20 minutes. And I come back and I do the Carl Sagan speech about a million years of juggling. And it was such a fun kind of moment. Like, it was also a fun moment in the show when I opened my mouth there, because we're back to a familiar place. We're back to a familiar relationship. And that was really cool. And but the thing I learned that was kind of funny, and I don't know what you say about this, but when I do speak after that juggling section, then I don't say anything. Well, I do state facts again, but I am kind of just making things up. It's a Eric Langekell speech. I'm talking about Carl Sagan and his wife, Andrianne, and it's all very straightforward statements. But of course, the ending is a very fantastical little twist on the concrete words. But it felt like I had a liberty there when I came back to talk to the audience. I could say whatever I wanted. Ooh. I could have recited a poem. I could have said the sky is purple, whatever. And they would have followed me. Like, I felt that there was a familiarity, like, oh, he's talking to me again. I know what that, like, we've had that relationship before.
Trust.
Yeah, that's cool.
It has to do with trust. They trust you, yeah.
Yeah, it felt good. But then I also felt I had a freedom to say whatever I wanted. I didn't have to feel like I had to build an argument with them anymore. So we had really done our job in the first section, I guess is what I'm saying. I don't know. But it was really a nice, fun thing. It was like such a free moment for the audience and for me. I could just tell my story. Everybody was cool. No stress. Done. It was great.
Nice.
And then into the end of the show. And again, that rhythm of like 10 more minutes of juggling, little speech to set up the balls that fall apart, and then the balls that fall apart. So like that overall structure of the show, whether we, how consciously or intentionally we made that format or not as a big picture, I think was something that really got discovered in New York and is the really valuable, was the really valuable thing of that work that we did.
And I think, like you keep sort of saying, it's like, oh, like it was done whilst we were unaware or whatever. And you know, and this was really what was discovered in New York. And what I feel like is that you discovered what we had made in New York. It was always there. But you learned to fully embody each of those moments and to know that thing to such an extent that you could actually now alter some of the bits, because the structure of the whole thing starts to become clear to you.
There's always the two things. This is something I'm so obsessed with for like a few years now. There's what you think you're doing and there's what you're actually doing.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is, and I'm totally with you. That's so nice you said that out loud, because you're totally right. We thought we were doing one thing. Oh, I'm just making the end of the show here. Or, oh, I'm just making the end of the talking section here. What we're actually doing is something a little bit different. And it's not obvious to us because we're too close to it, or there's too many, we're deep in. But if you zoom out.
We spoke for like a year and a half. And in that process, it's not a coincidence that there was great skill in the beginning, that it was 20 minutes of talking mirrored by 20 minutes of doing. And we kept making these. But the basic structure of the show we kind of had, and the details were changing along the way and whatever. And it's an odd choice to have two sections of 20 minutes with smaller sections at the beginning and end. But we crafted that, and then you fully brought it into being by pulling out the right things and by your inflection and by everything. So, I'm so happy that so much of it worked. And I just find this thing, I know I say it a lot, and maybe it's because I am interested in Heidegger or I'm interested in phenomenology or whatever, but this thing of coming into being is that we make the script, which is like we're writing the poem or whatever. But then I remember just hearing like David White, when he goes, you're standing out there and you're reading your poem, and then whilst you're reading it and you aren't even altering the words of it, you're realizing that the poem is much greater than what you first intended. And then because you now have discovered these things in the middle of telling the poem, the audience gets this next level of meaning the very first time when they hear the poem. And you're standing out there and you're just going like, this is more powerful. And it is just because once you've made it, it's a thing on its own. And this is you saying, it's like, oh, it's this structure, it's this framework that we have that you can insert all sorts of stuff into. And we kind of can now, because that thing has come into being. Well, it's been brought into being by you doing it. It's now not just something that's written on paper with a potential. It was there. People saw it, and they then went home and tweeted. So you woke up the next day with another 100 followers or whatever on Instagram, because one specific person had texted out that he loved the show and the most innovative thing that he'd seen. And it was like, so
there was one funny thing that happened in the show, and maybe we can kind of wrap up with this or something, or however you feel, but I haven't told you this yet, but it was kind of funny, and I hadn't thought about it much, but I remembered it was kind of something I wanted to try again. So gonna go to New York, right? Oh man, am I gonna get on the airplane? I don't know. It's COVID. It's Omicron. You know, gotta have a negative test to get on the airplane. Am I negative? I don't know. Like, hope I can go to New York and not throw away a year and a half of our lives. And then, oh, I'm getting on the airplane, gonna go there. And I mean, also I've been working just, you know, you too, but I've been working on this show so hard, like night and day, right? Just 24 hours a day. For months, and so I'm pretty exhausted and pretty overwhelmed, and it's such a big project, but there's so many unknowns is bigger problem. Am I going to get to New York? Can we open the show? Is there going to be any audience? Can we legally do a show? Are we going to get shut down? So mentally it was really exhausting and very heavy. And then also loading into the theater that first week and setting everything up and hanging the 75 lights and doing the light tech, which was something crazy. Like, it took like 6 or 7 hours to do the first 5 minutes of the show with the lights. It's just beyond like my capacity, really. Like, I was mentally and physically just completely dead, but also very excited, like full of adrenaline for this project we'd done. And so I remember the first week of shows, I carried that exhaustion onto stage with me, but I did it unconsciously. So like, when I get to the end of the show and I make that last speech about the balls, the Ivar balls that are going to fall apart, I'm like literally just exhausted, and I'm just dripping with sweat, and my energy is really, I'm just wiped out. And there was a bit of an angst to how I gave the text a couple of times, because I was leaning into how I actually felt. And I kind of realized a week into the run, I was like, oh man, I'm bringing all this exhaustion onto stage with me. Maybe I can leave it behind. And I think in the end, it was a more sustainable choice, because after that first week of shows, I kind of vowed to myself, I was going to go on stage and do the show as a happy, well-rested person, whether I was or not. And I was doing like 3 shows a day many times. So I was I was messed up, dude. But I just made a conscious choice to be like, I'm not going to let the exhaustion, you know, define what I'm doing. And then the show took on a very different kind of rhythm and kind of energy. And my presentation was very different. And I think for the better, it was a good choice the show got more streamlined, right? It got snappier. Because we were editing the text, we were learning how the show. So that whole process kind of helped each other to go, you know, through a more concise, precise show. But I think the show also lost something. Like, it lost maybe a touch, like 1% of authenticity. Because that first week, man, I was really like, at the end of the show, it was pretty dramatic. Like, sometimes, because I would do the end 10 minutes of juggling is all the best stuff. So I was just like I was really going for it until I couldn't do anything more. And then at the end, to do the cascade for 3 or 4 minutes was, I mean, it was heavy, man. And I would wear that on my face and in my body. And so it was kind of funny to make that conscious choice, like a week into the work, and say, nope, I'm going to, you know, try to be more intentional or more in control of how my performance goes. And at the same time, realizing maybe I did lose a little bit of quality of realness or something that I think was contributing to some emotional impact of the show. Because you're watching this guy who goes through this journey over the hour and 20 minutes, who, you know, really does exhaust himself and really, and not just exhausting yourself, but like giving your all for what you believe in. Like, it was really clear in that first week of shows, I really believed in juggling. Like, you just couldn't question it, because I was just killing myself for it. Like, probably literally. I mean, you know, like on stage, out of breath, like can't, you know, and then I had to give the text. And yeah, it was a little bit of a funny, yeah, something I noticed there.
But that's great. That's and I guess that's where we then step into the world a little bit of acting, of where you can, where we think of, oh, you, as if Kurt Cobain was somehow more authentic because he just wore what t-shirt he had on when he woke up that day, or whether he, you also, you had chosen to wear that because that's what you wanted to portray or whatever. So you, so you can, you can take that thing on and channel it towards that last bit, and as you get more familiar with it, you can also go, well, there is a need of more authenticity here, or like, oh, this was, what was the 2% that was lost, and what, how could I put that back in again? Just like when I make a mistake in the records that actually gets a big laugh, then you gotta reassess the situation and see, what do I need to do to make that mistake happen reliably every night, or mistake in quotation marks, like.
Yeah, I think
you have to reverse engineer it a little bit and go, okay, well, if that was something that was lost, possibly even look at, we can look at one of the videos from the early shows. And then if we're going to look at two videos, watch one when you really felt like, I remember this one, this was. And then I often find, though, that sometimes I look at then the show that I'm unhappy about, and then I have the other one, and both of them are filmed, and then invariably 9 months goes, and then I finally have time to look at it, and I haven't labeled which tape is which day. And then I look at it and I go, I can't tell which one was which. And then you realize that a lot of what's going on inside you and how tired you are or whatever might just be that you actually were exhausted, and that in the end, you, you know, I don't know, but it's a good, really interesting thing point.
Maybe, I mean, this thing of being exhausted, I don't think it's so interesting in terms of, like, I mean, that's just a physical.
Just to give all.
But yeah, that you give all, but also I think maybe more fun to talk about in the future is the idea that I realized in that first week, to say it in another way, I was letting the process come on the stage with me. And I think making a conscious decision after that first week to not let the process come into the work and let the work stand on its own as its own thing, that also helped the show mature. That also helped decouple the show from what I thought it was, from what I thought I was doing, into letting it be what it was actually doing. And that was maybe a more significant, I just thought of that now, obviously, but like.
That's very interesting. Yeah, it's almost like what you had made was a poem already, and though that the poet comes on and is very sad and tells you a sad story, and now I'm going to read this poem, then you'll reflect that into it. But even when you take that out, the poem still stands on its own and will make all sorts of connections, even though they might not be specifically towards that, all the stress that you had gone through that you brought with you or whatever. Yeah,
totally. No, I think so. But I think about that a lot. I think about it a lot when I see shows. Is the process of the show transparent on stage when I watch the show? And I would say 99.9% of the time, I hate seeing process on stage when it's transparent, where you just go, like, you watch a show and you see a scene and you go, oh, I know exactly what happened in rehearsal the day they made that. You can, like, construct a story in your head. Normally, it's because it's bad. It's bad. And so I kind of have this, like, aversion to having my process be seen on stage unintentionally.
Yeah.
And that was that moment a week into the shows where I was like, oh, I got to stop bringing this weight with me. I have to do this as it needs to be true to itself.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
That was a fun, I mean, yeah, that was a weird thing too, to go through. I haven't really clearly done that before. So that was something I learned as well, but.
Very good. It's also like something to, there's a lot of topics where we thought that we'd start this by making a another retrospective look at the show, and hopefully there's been some stuff here that people can connect to. I know that in the past people have connected the things we talk about, and that we talk so specific details and talk so much about the craft, that I hope that there's lessons and ideas and things that might influence or irritate people about how we just go on about stuff, how we spoke for 35 minutes about hi, my name is Jay and I'm a juggler, but hopefully then by the end of it you'll see, like, part of why we're talking so much about it, it was that that was a very hard discovery to make of just how in naff that first line would be to take it up or whatever. So I hope hope that the conversation becomes valuable in reflection to any show that anyone is actually then doing or whatever.
Well,
and then we have lots of.
This has been a good wrap up of like this arc of me calling you from when I was on the playground with my son, asking you to direct me a show. And now we kind of did a little public summary here. And of course, the crazy thing of the project is that it's still going on. Like we're still talking about the next version and we're talking about notes for the future. But this is a little bit of a bow on the first phase.
Yeah. So huge that birth when it comes out. It's like the first year that a child is alive. That's when the big things happen. They learn to sit and then they learn to walk and they learn to talk. And you start to see the first shimmerings of who they actually are or whatever as they start to talk and start to express themselves. So this is certainly that birth of that show. It's still just one season old, 35 shows or whatever. And already the plans are in the works for restaging the show. And from the producer's point of view of some of the ideas of what could make it easier to tour, et cetera, and whatever. So lots of great stuff for us to delve into. But when
I can't wait till the show grows up and we can franchise it. We have like 10 reflexes running consecutively.
Yeah, yeah. And once my Rubber Man stuff fails, then I can buy into your franchise and I can quickly learn to do 7 balls and juggle the music sticks or whatever.
But I'm super excited to talk about the next recording we do, man. You have some good new fresh things we haven't talked about before. So
So we're changing the topic completely, but this will sort of bring people back onto the wavelength of how you and me talk together, and it'll also hopefully sort of give the people a little bit of a reflection, some reflection on how stuff goes from being talked about and some of the issues that we met, even though they weren't huge, but just that struggle that you have of making your dream the thing that came from nothing, like we'd kept talking about. It's like we sat down and we just really had no idea of what a show would be, and we had to talk through 12 hours of conversation before we could even start putting the first bit of the show together or whatever. So hopefully this is reflected in all this talk that comes out. And when we now move on to other different topics, that we'll all take this with us and
right on.
Good stuff. Cool.
Thanks, Frodo. So are you gonna press stop record?
I'm gonna press stop recording right now, and I'll talk to you soon again. All right.
Absolutely.
Bye for now.
Thanks.
And just like that, we press the stop button and we are back here alone, just you and me. And I'm going to wrap this up real quick. Just if you did enjoy what you heard here today, why not send me an email and tell me about it at thewayoftheshowman@gmail.com. Or you can, as a couple of excellent people have done here lately, maybe buy me a coffee on buymeacoffee.com/Captain Frodo. And thanks to the Dirty Scoop and to someone for the contributions since last time. So, tell some friends about it. That's the best way. Anyway, it's a pleasure that you are here. So I'm not always going to ask you to do... Well, actually, I am always going to ask you to do it, because maybe one day you actually will do it. Anyway, that's all I have to say for today. And that's what me and Jay had to say. So until next time, take care of yourself and all those people you love. And I hope to see you along the way.